Hello and welcome to the MisesUK.org podcast, is sponsored by finlingo.com. Tonight on show 17, I'll be speaking to Tom Rogers, who recently wrote a runner-up essay for our Mises UK essay competition. This was entitled, Oil Wars, Is This an Accurate Summary of US-led Interventions in the Middle East and the 21st Century? We'll be exploring that topic in a little more depth tonight as we approach nearly three decades of heavy Western involvement in the Middle East. This was all since President Reagan pulled out the US Marines from Lebanon in 1984, and this was seen by many at the time as a major strategic mistake. Good evening, Tom.
Good evening, Andy. Nice to speak to you.
Fantastic. Now, first of all, before we get going with business, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Of course, yes. Well, my background is quite eclectic. I've done a lot of different things and I've held different views over the years. I've been on both the left and the right, and I've always tended to verge towards the radical end of the political spectrum. I would say my views and beliefs now transcend the left and right, and I don't fit into ordinary distinctions, though I am a nationalist, and to the extent that I'm a libertarian, it's by disposition rather than by doctrine.
Yeah, I've got a similar background. I was a socialist, and I read Human Action, and I immediately became a Misesian as soon as I finished reading it. Now, as I said earlier, the title of the essay was, I'll just repeat it again, Oil Wars, Is This an Accurate Summary of US-led Interventions in the Middle East of the 21st Century? From all the subjects you could have written about for our essay competition, why did you write about this particular one?
Yes, well, there were preset topics and I found all the topics interesting, but since I'm not strictly a libertarian, at least not by political label, though I'm clearly interested in libertarianism, but not being a strict libertarian, it seems sensible for me to focus on foreign policy as opposed to domestic economics and libertarian strategies, which, if I recall correctly, were the other two topics.
Okay. Now, many in the Austrian movement do regard warfare as just an extension of statism, part of parcel of what Rothbard would call the welfare warfare state. Now, Randolph Bourne famously said war is the health of the state. And I suppose we could say that Hopper would explain this by saying the states are always going through an evolutionary process to eventually have one of them take over the world. Mm. So war for them becomes a necessity under this theory, though it's a highly risky tool to achieve this global domination. Now, in the essay, you spent a lot of time explaining what we might call the basic human root causes of warfare. Why did you give this so much airtime?
Could partly be explained by what you've just said, Andy, because that was very interesting. But from my eyes or to my ears, that sounds very much like a description of almost a biological or a biopolitical process, because I tend to look at things from a prime mover perspective. And so the essay I wrote is looking for or exploring or speculating about a primary cause of warfare that has its roots in human nature or common human behavior, if you prefer. And that's what interests me.
Yeah, I mean, we do see even chimpanzee groups do have territorial fights against each other, don't they, where they wave sticks around and actually attack each other.
Yes.
Now, again, as Hoppians, we would hope, you might disagree completely because you're not a pure Hoppian like I am. We'd hope that once states do get massively reduced in size, if that happens, and we get this Hoppianization of the world, and property and freedom get respected again, that wars will become much smaller and much less frequent and ideally even disappear. Or in a kind of reasonable worst case, just become small defensive actions by private insurance companies defending property from aggression. Do you think, however, not being a Hoppian, that war is just something that's always going to be with us?
In a word, yes, but in a funny way, there is a coincidence between what I think and what you've actually just said. I mean, maybe the better word is conflict, but we can use the word war because semantically there's little difference in the context I will address here. The notion of war that we are most familiar with is macrocosmic, but I would argue that war is something that happens at a very mundane microcosmic level in our everyday lives. The war of the sexes, the low-intensity war between different ethnic groups that occurs due to the imposition of diversity, wars between commercial rivals as a reality of business, which you've just alluded to, the class war, and so on and so forth. The colloquialisms for these wars are various and include conflict, competition, racism, sexism, or whatever, but my point is that ontically, I just see the wars referred to in the essay title as extensions of that basic feature of human nature, which I view as Hobbesian in character, in that it tends towards conflict, and this seems to be a pattern across human societies. So Hobbes talked about man in the primitive state of nature being war of all against all. And, so when I'm kind of therefore stylizing human nature as something where everybody is at war with each other, not necessarily in the conventional sense, but war can take on the sense of being conflict in that people have different interests. And so I would say it goes back to three common factors, which I would call sex, space, and tribe, all of which I think are facets of human nature. I mean, you could quibble with that, with my terminology, and you could say, but it's not human nature, and, you know, that Hobbes was wrong, it's just common human behaviour. But I'm not sure that really matters.
Well, I think this is where we need morality, isn't it? And we also need definitions of what property is and who owns the property, and because then people try to grab the property of others, and then that leads to the conflict. But if we have clear, defined boundaries and everyone accepts them, or at least most people, then things will get a little bit better. Now, speaking of the war of all against all, in the essay you also spent quite a bit of time going into George Orwell's 1984 with Oceania, Eurasia and East Asia, all locked into this perpetual three-way war. Now, in the book, that's said to be designed to prop up all the ruling oligarchs in each of the three states who all know what they're doing. Do you think we've got a similar kind of perpetual war going on in the real world?
Yes, I think so. I think that, in my opinion, it is just a reality of human nature. It just depends on what kind of form it takes, but in the form that is similar, literally similar to that described by Orwell, yes, I believe that war, the form it takes is a war between commercial interests. I mean, what Orwell is of interest to me, because although I wouldn't say he was a great writer, he's not an exemplar of the English canon in the sense that, say, Dickens is, but he's my favourite writer, along with the American Jack London. But both Orwell and London have had a significant effect on my political beliefs, especially. I discussed Orwell in the essay for two reasons, because the novel 1984 is partly about war, not just in the ontically conventional sense that most people recognise, but also in the sense I would recognise. Orwell is referring explicitly to mundane social and interpersonal warfare, not as a dissonant dynamic in society, but as a cohesive dynamic. He talks about both a class war and also a war between the sexes, and how both the reality and fantasy of those things can be manipulated. And I think, going back to the question you've just asked me, that's what happens in reality. I mean, to make the point simply, Orwell is telling us that Oceania is a society at war, not just at war fictionally or factually with other superpowers, but also at war with itself. And the purpose of the inner party's ideology of oligarchical collectivism is to maintain that internal war, as that is an essential predicate of this pseudo-rational utopia of tyrannical collectivism that the ruling elite use to maintain their power. But just taking that theme further, this departs a bit from the question you've just asked, but I'm also interested in the way that Orwell uses linguistics. And this is a point I've not heard made by anybody else, but it seems to me that what Orwell is doing, probably not intentionally, is highlighting the way that language achieves singularities of meaning. And this is something that segues nicely into my thoughts on war as a natural phenomenon. Orwell, as you know, he had a great interest in political language, but he uses opposites to make a point about mass psychological manipulation. So on the Ministry of Truth Building, it says war is peace, freedom is slavery, etc. Those are posited by Orwell as dichotomies, but I would argue that they aren't dichotomies. In fact, they are singularities. War really is peace, because man is warlike by nature, and peace is just a warlike dispensation that we have to accommodate our awkward nature. It was the Romans who began the use of the word peace in a similar sense. They referred to a Pax Romana. I think it was Seneca who first coined the term, and it was used to denote the Roman imperial order. It's obvious looking at the history of that period, but it didn't mean an actual peace, as in the absence of violence. And freedom really is slavery, because any systemized order is implicitly slave-like. So the answer is either to meta-systemize social orders or de-systemize human arrangements altogether and return to some sort of tribalism. So in that sense, my beliefs kind of do, you know, align quite well with libertarianism. And I don't think war or conflict is something that, however, that's ever going to leave us. So what I'm getting at here is that you need to have a recognition and a respect for boundaries between both individuals and groups of individuals.
Well, that's what we, of course, Hoppians, Property and Freedom, we're all about. Now, did Jack London write The Seawolf? Because I'm currently reading The Seawolf.
Yes.
Ah, that's a brilliant,
he did.
Brilliant book, yeah. Fantastic. Yes, of course, the Romans with the Temple of Janus, where they, I can't remember whether they closed the doors or opened the doors during times of war, but eventually they were either always closed or always open because they were always at war. Now, getting back to the essay, the US does actually have plenty of its own oil. It's got enormous reserves in Alaska, North Dakota, and the Gulf of Mexico and so on. It doesn't really need to import much oil from the Middle East at all. In fact, I'm not sure whether they import any. So why is it often involved, the US, in Middle Eastern oil wars?
Well, I think the simple answer, to be fair, is that the US-led interventions are wars for oil. My answer to the essay was in the affirmative, but I'm proposing, of course, in the essay, as I've explained, is a regression back to first cause. My argument is that oil is simply a proxy explanation for deeper human drives. But with all that said, the essay question demands some explication, as you rightly say. So in the essay, I do go into that, and I justify myself by explaining that war is essentially a commercial endeavor, and US foreign policy is a projection of US business interests. I acknowledge what you say, Andy, although only a minority of oil production in the United States has its origin in Middle East extraction. Nevertheless, the Middle East is both an important source of oil and also an important part of the oil pricing market. And furthermore, as I explained in the essay, the petrol dollar system is of significant importance to public expenditure by the US federal government. So to my mind, it does make sense that the US would take an active interest in the Middle East for those reasons, apart from other reasons. I know there are other reasons, and they are significant too. But when I put forward a commercial explanation like that, I'm not arguing in the same way as someone like Noam Chomsky. I don't believe in dissolving moral distinctions completely when it comes to explaining US foreign policy, and I do accept that there are ethical particularities that guide it. Though, like Chomsky, I think they are secondary, and, you know, this whole international humanitarianism thing, if you like, is often, that's just a rationalization for harder-nosed interests. But at the same time, I don't go as far as a neoconservative like, say, Robert Kaplan, who argues that you need an organizing hegemony in order to offset the Hobbesian character of the world. But I do agree with him that the world, the human social world, has a Hobbesian character, which we've discussed, and that is a root explanation of war.
Yeah, I like the technical explanation that the petrodollar, since the US came off gold in 71, they had to base the dollar on something.
Yes.
So they based it on oil, and so we get the petrodollar. Now, speaking of the neocons, the neoconservatives in the United States, they've got a long list of what they call rogue states, including Iran, the biggest in the Middle East, perhaps. They've also got North Korea and so on. Do you think these neocons still have that strong sway over the US military and foreign policy that they definitely had, say, 15 years ago?
I think they're still a major factor. But in the essay, when I address the matter of neoconservatism and the neocons, and I think I also mentioned the Zionist lobby as well, which could be distinguished from them, what interests me about that is the extent to which there is a co-alignment of interests. I think this is a point that is missed by people who critique or criticize Zionist influence, in that they fail to realize or take account of the possibility that the reason Israel and pro-Israel lobbies are influential in the US and similar countries may be because those interests are thought to dovetail with those of the US. And I think they do. Of course, that doesn't mean that those interests are the same as the interests of the American people or indeed the British people. They're not, but the essay is covering what governments do, not what the native populations of the US and US allied countries want.
Yeah, we will be publishing, for anyone interested, we will be publishing the essay very, very soon. As soon as I can get Mr. Martland to pull his finger out on that one. Now, again, coming back to the neocons, Russia's held up as the ultimate enemy number one in a kind of James Bond lair style. On the other hand, though, if I'm a little bit Russian in my background, and if I was a chess playing Russian, I'd be very concerned about that growing ring of military bases which surround Mother Russia. Do you think that we actually have anything real to fear from Russia, or should we just let the Cold War die?
Well, I think you've got to look at the nature of Russia, really. in my view, Russia is not a nationalist state as such. In my view, the Russian Federation is an empire in the truest sense. As such, Putin's Russia and Putinism, if you like, I see as an extension of Sovietism. The Russian Federation in its political and economic structures looks a lot like the USSR to me. And, you know, I tend towards simplification in other words, Russia just wants the same thing as the USA. There's no ideology as such. There are just interests. And the same applies to the Russia's precursor, the USSR. I don't believe the Cold War was really about ideology. You know, I think it was about profit, which, if you think about it, is sort of the same as saying that US-led interventions are about oil. It's regressing back and saying, well, look, yeah, the Iraq War, for instance, was about oil. And yes, the Cold War was a sort of postmodern fiction and really just about pursuing profit. And that's because these explanations aren't really explanations at all. They're just literate fictions or rationalizations for what all powerful elites tend to do. You can just see them as gangs. But just taking a step back into history, just briefly, the way I conceptualize a Cold War is very different to most people in that I reject, first of all, the idea that the USSR was socialist or communist. It was neither. It was capitalist, specifically state capitalist. So I conceptualize Cold War diplomacy and proxy war making, if you like, in a very postmodern deconstructionist way. I take the rhetorical chiseled to it and say, look, it was just a fight between two ruling elites who actually had a great deal in common. They were both capitalist elites. The idea that Russia today is some sort of behemoth tiger constantly threatening the United States, I'm very skeptical about that. Even in relation to its precursor, the USSR. The USSR, in my opinion, was just a commercial entity, almost akin to a business. And I see no reason to view Russia differently, and not least when you take into account Russia's military strength, which is greatly less than that of the United States and even Britain.
Yeah, well, coming back to Airstrip 1, just as a final part, we've got the marionette, the plucky old UK. Now, particularly under, of course, Tony Blair, the UK was often used in the last 20 years as a kind of cover for military action with 45 minutes to attack us and so on. Do you think Britain going forward, away from the legacy of Tony Blair, can actually stop all of these Middle East wars? Or in the infamous words of Moll Gerald in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, has Britain just become too irrelevant to matter?
I think Britain matters, but Britain should decide how it wants to matter. I think the root problem there is that the model, the neoliberal model of a nation state is somewhat, somewhat of a problem. It may even, could even be seen as dangerous in that it's very expansive and interventionist due to this need we've talked about, which was intellectualized by the neoconservatives, which is to spread, well, yeah, I talk about it in the essay, which is to spread commercially friendly civic and political values. And, you know, that interventionism seems to turn into a mandate for suppressing natural boundaries, both within allied countries and the states that are intervened in. So I question the viability of that, because if you acknowledge the existence and importance of a natural order, though, no nation state of that kind can exist, or maybe it can in the Oceania sense, in the sense of Airstrip 1, in that you could have this constant state of internal warfare between, and then maybe that's a way, that dissonance is a way of keeping societies together so that they're constantly at war, people are constantly at war with each other, and the elites then can manage the tension. So where I go with that insight in terms of British foreign policy, if it were to serve the interests of the British people as opposed to the interests of an abusive elite, would be that it needs to begin with an acknowledgement of sovereignty at all levels of society, not just internationally. And the first practical step towards a sovereignty-respecting foreign policy would be strategic neutrality. People think that makes us irrelevant because it would mean, in my view, it would mean leaving all the sovereignty-denying organisations like the EU, NATO, the United Nations. But actually, I think that approach would make us more fit for today's multilateral realities. Because at the end of the day, people look at the debate about Brexit and the EU. People say, well, if we leave the EU can stop us trading with European countries. But it can't, because it's not Britain and the EU that trade. It's businesses, consumers, to some extent, who participate in trade multilaterally with each other. So, you know, the neutrality and respecting sovereignty would actually make us more of a liberal country. It would, and it would help us also guarantee the future of the British people.
Okay, Tom, it was great to speak to you tonight. Are you working on anything at the moment, or do you have a website where we can find out more about you?
I do, but I'm working on that. So I can always add something in the comments as and when that's ready. But I am very busy with work at the moment, so that can be difficult. But yes, if I do develop anything further, I will let you know. if it's of relevance to the Mises Institute.
Okay, thank you very much for your time tonight, Tom Rogers.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed tonight's programme on the MisesUK.org podcast. If you'd like to help us out, we'd really appreciate any 5-star ratings or reviews you can give us on iTunes, or you can share our links on your favourite social media sites. You can also help us out by going to our donate page at MisesUK.org and making a contribution, where I'm sure that our glorious chairman, Keir Martland, will be more than willing to help you make the world a better place by taking your hard, cold cash to ensure the future of MisesUK.org. We'll be back soon with episode 18 of the Mises UK podcast. In the meantime, please look after your property and freedom responsibly.